This is a continuation of the interview with Aaron Ide, and today we're talking about the Integrated Liberal Studies program. This is the 22nd of July, and we're interviewing in his office in the chemistry building. Yes, you were going to begin with saying many people have spoken about the link of the ILS with the experimental college, so we'll move on from that, and you wanted to say something about the Daniels Curriculum Committee.
Yes, I think that there is a link to the Daniels Committee report of about 1939 or 40, which dealt with the place of science in the general curriculum in letters and science. The Daniels report had some influence in bringing about the creation of the History of Science department a few years later. And it also had an influence in getting the faculty to think about how general science courses in the university ought to be approached. There had been some attempts to create survey courses in each of the sciences, but these survey courses were counterproductive and were soon abandoned.
We're just testing the tape to see if it's where this noise is coming from.
All right, I'll just say a few words in general. You can erase it. These survey courses were usually taught by someone who was not particularly interested and taken by students who were anxious to work off a science requirement as inexpensively as possible.
Well, we'll go on.
A little more on, and
maybe if I got this a little closer to you.
Yes.
It really very close.
All right. Sure.
If you just say a few words that there.
It's yes. Fine. I'll test this thing and see how it comes. Yeah. Let's see, are we recording?
Yes.
All right. Well, while the Daniels report did not have any direct connection with ILS, I think that it brought about some faculty thinking, which ultimately fed into the science program, which was created in ILS. Then, of course, there's the Ogg report, which has been reviewed before, so I'll say no more about it, except that it contained this recommendation for a curriculum B, besides the major curricular changes known as curriculum A. Curriculum B was then moved to a new committee, which was created by Dean Ingram, and of which Robert Pooley of the English department was chairman. Pooley...
I'm curious, do you know on what basis he chose the committee?
Yes. Oh. I was going to speak of that. All right. Pooley was chosen for the committee not because of any deep-seated past interest in general education, but because he was chairman of the freshman English program, which was required of all entering freshmen. The English department, I understand, had shown some fear about what ILS or what curriculum B might happen to do to the freshman English requirement. And so they were anxious that somebody from the department be involved, and since Pooley was chairman of freshman English, he became involved. I do not know if he went to Dean Ingram and asked to be involved, or if the chairman of the English department asked for him to be placed on the committee. At any rate, Ingram made him chairman of the committee.
I'm curious what they thought was going to happen to freshman English.
To the extent that I recall any discussions with Professor Pooley, it was largely that there might be an attempt to bypass a freshman English equivalent or in some way undermine freshman English. For example, if curriculum B did not include an English composition requirement, this would be looked upon as a hazard by the English department. At any rate, Pooley was made chairman of the committee. Others on the committee included someone from philosophy whose name I don't recall, Richard Hartshorn of the geography department, Homer Adkins, a prominent research chemist in the chemistry department. I believe Walter Agard was a member of the committee, and I don't recollect the others without checking out the report.
I have a list of them, but not with me.
Yes, all right, fine. At least I think Agard, Hartshorn, Adkins, and Pooley are the key figures.
Harrington was on that.
Say, Harrington was on that, yes. And Curdy may have been.
No.
He wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
No. All right, well, at any rate.
Which is puzzling to me.
Yes. Curdy was very interested in ILS, and I'm sure he had some background influence. He was always friendly to the program.
I wonder why he wasn't on the committee, though, since he was more or less responsible for starting the whole thing.
Yes. He may have been deeply involved in some research or away from Madison at the time, something of that nature. I don't know why Curdy wasn't on the committee, because he was the sort of person who have had a good deal of influence. And as I remember the faculty meetings which discussed curriculum B, Curdy was present and defending the curriculum B program. At any rate, the committee came up with a report. Before making the report, there were one or two LNS faculty meetings in which the gist of the report was presented unofficially and discussed.
Were these what they called the hearings?
These were the hearings, mm-hmm. Yes. And I think the hearings probably helped in paving the way for ultimate acceptance by the LNS faculty, because there was a lot of antagonism toward this type of program. But the antagonists largely got it out of their system. And they perhaps had some influence in changing parts of the program to make them more palatable.
Can you elaborate on that? Do you remember any specific examples?
Well, as I remember, Ricardo Quintana of the English department was very unfriendly toward this sort of program. And British historian, whose name escapes me at the moment,
Napland,
was very unfriendly toward it. Some of the scientists had doubts, though I don't remember a great deal of opposition from the science departments.
There was one science department, I assume it must have been physics,
yes,
that wouldn't join the program, at least for a while.
Well,
I don't know that it was. Physics
was always unfriendly, but botany was equally unfriendly, as I recall, and geology had reservations.
They all thought it was too general. Is that?
They feared that these would be survey courses, mm-hmm, which attempted to do too much, and therefore did not really teach science.
But people like Napland and Quintana?
They had the same reservations with respect to the humanistic and social areas. I think also, in the tone of the opposition, as I remember it many years ago, you could sense a feeling that the departments might be losing control of the curriculum. And therefore, they'd better not let something like this get started, because it might erode the curriculum later on. Certainly, this was some of the argument used in the early 60s when the basic studies program was debated in faculty meeting. At any rate, the committee ultimately came up with its report, and the report was accepted. I might say that Pooley became exceedingly interested in general education as a result of this chairmanship. He traveled around the country. He did a great deal of writing to schools which had programs, and he made site visits of some of these schools, such as Columbia, University of Chicago, and others that had programs of sorts. I think one of the things that he found was that the sciences generally got short shrift in these programs. Columbia had an early and excellent program in the humanities and social sciences, but they never were successful in getting the scientists involved. Chicago got the scientists involved, but somewhat unhappily. Pooley was able to look at programs of all sorts that were in existence in the late 40s. And he was very shrewd in evaluating these programs and picking out the weak spots, and then came back to his own committee and pointed out the things that were weak spots. And I think the curriculum B avoided the weak spots of many of the programs elsewhere. For example, many of the schools had a separate faculty to teach their general program. Wisconsin borrowed its faculty from existing departments and used its own faculty members, most of whom were already established, instead of recruiting a separate faculty which would do only general education. They also avoided the isolation which had hurt the experimental college. The e-college students were off in a dorm, Adams Hall. Their faculty was also isolated, and there was very little interchange with students on the Hill. ILS avoided that. And I think Pooley proved to be an exceedingly shrewd chairman who had a great deal to do with coming up with a good program. Now, with respect to the sciences, this had been the trouble area in programs virtually everywhere. Some schools didn't even try to include the sciences. Where they did, the science courses were generally the weak spot. Fortunately, Pooley's committee had men like Agard and Hartshorne on it. I'm sorry, not Agard, Adkins, Homer Adkins, the chemist. And Adkins, as I remember him, had always had an exceedingly keen mind, which saw problems before they became problems. And Hartshorne, on the other hand, wanted to create a completely designed program. I understand that Adkins and Hartshorne fought out their problems a great deal, and that Adkins pretty much won, in that he argued, let's not write the course, let's simply designate what the course will deal with, and then look for a good faculty member to teach it and give him a free hand to teach it as he sees fit. Hartshorne, on the other hand, had wanted to design the courses, and Adkins persuaded the committee that this was folly, that the important thing was to find a talented faculty member and let him design the course and teach it as he saw fit. So these are some of the background things. I don't know if you have any further questions.
I have two questions. One is, the Great Books Program was very much at its height then.
It was, yes.
You were aware of that, the committee
yes.
was, I suppose.
The committee was certainly aware of the Great Books Program. I think that they did not want to create a program around the Great Books, mm-hmm. as St. John's College mm-hmm. Ultimately did. That they felt that there were other motivations than a set of books.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The other one is, you speak of a general science course, but as I understood it, there was a general botany course one semester and then a general zoology, or isn't that the way?
Well, the science program that was presented to the faculty called for a physical universe course, which would draw its material from chemistry, physics, and astronomy,
mm.
to be followed by an earth science course, which would be largely geology, but could include meteorology and some geography,
mm-hmm.
to be followed by a biology course of 1 year duration.
Uh-huh.
So this was the science setting.
Yeah. Right.
Well, now when we come to implementation, as I remember it, the faculty passed or approved curriculum B in spring of 47. Ingram immediately appointed Robert Pooley to be chairman of a department which would administer ILS. This was another feature which I think Pooley had much to do with in curriculum B's investigation. Did you erase that?
I did. I didn't recall.
Oh, I see. Okay. At any rate, just stop it for a moment. In creating curriculum B, the committee decided that it ought to be administered as a department rather than as a program which was very diffuse as far as administration was concerned, and Pooley was appointed chairman by Dean Ingram. You ask about President Fred. He was not directly involved in the creation or staffing of ILS, but Fred was quite sympathetic toward the program, which may seem a bit surprising because his background was very, very much in science. But he, as president, I think, became very thoughtful about academic problems and recognized ILS as something that was worth a serious try.
Uh-huh. All right.
I don't know if he had any role in appointment of Pooley, but I think that Pooley was the natural chairman because of his work as chairman of the committee that created mm-hmm. curriculum B. The term ILS seems to have been suggested by Dean Ingram.
Oh.
And I believe that Pooley discussed this in his interview, so I'll not go into the basis for it further. At any rate, Pooley's first job was creating a faculty, and it was understood that the faculty would be borrowed from existing departments. A few of the faculty members were certainly designated at the time that the curriculum committee was working, because Agard ended up on the faculty and so did Hartshorn and Pooley. Finding the rest of the... at any rate, Pooley recruited what turned out to be a quite excellent faculty with two or three exceptions, and the program was on the road. The faculty designate had many meetings in Pooley's office, during that previous year.
I have some questions there. I think you said that he went to the chairman of the departments when he was going to ask somebody to join.
That's right. He did. He tried to look over the existing faculty and pick people who he thought had vision to create create courses which would fit into the program. So he did go to departmental chairman and ask permission to talk to such a person. And in that way, I think he avoided some of the problems that would have been encountered if he had gone to the faculty member first and sought his interest and then go to the chairman to see if he could be borrowed.
One department, he said, refused to let anybody, and he didn't name the department, refused to contribute anybody. Do you know who that was? Which department?
I don't know which department that was.
I speculate that it was physics, because physics seems to be it was a science department.
I don't think it was physics, because I was picked early to teach the physical universe course.
Oh, so.
And Pooley came to my chairman, Matthews, and sought permission to talk to me.
Uh-huh.
And I was interested. I had been interested even before. I had talked to Adkins at least once or twice about this program while it was still in process of being created. So I think that Adkins may have given him my name and fully followed it up. At least I think my chemistry, my general chemistry teaching had become known around the campus to the point where I might have been one of the people looked at. I am not sure that physics was ever invited to loan somebody into the program.
I suppose they must have looked for people who were especially good at and interested in teaching.
They did, yes. This was one of the prime criteria. And a number of the people who got into the program, like Agard, Reynolds, Post, were people who were foremost teachers on the campus. So effective undergraduate teaching was one criteria that Pooley was looking for. He was also looking for people who had the vision to meld together material from several different disciplines, as I put together material from astronomy and physics as well as chemistry. I doubt that physics was ever approached, though someone in physics may have remarked that they wouldn't give anybody to ILS even if approached.
Do you know whether anybody who was invited to do this turned it down?
I can't name names. I suspect there were some people who turned it down. Yes.
Who were the weaker members of the faculty?
The social sciences part of the program was never strong, and we had very few people in it who were effective ILS teachers.
Jim Early was one.
And by the way, Jim Early was a member of Curriculum
That's right.
B Committee.
Yes.
Yes. Jim Early believed in the ILS type of education, but he was an effective but not charismatic teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And his econ course, which he taught in the program, was looked upon as one of the courses that you got behind you rather than the course that you looked forward to. Though Jim had a very deep belief in ILS type education, but he himself could not put it across as effectively as certain others. The anthropology course, or early man as it was titled, went reasonably well, but again, it was usually the least liked course in the first semester. And
That must have been poor teaching, because it could have been fascinating.
It could have been exceedingly fascinating, but no anthropologist. No anthropologist ever had the same student following that was had by such people as Reynolds, Agard, and Nolan.
And yourself, I gather.
Well, I won't judge that.
Well, I read some.
But I feel that I did have good rapport with the students over the years, mm-hmm. and that my course was one of them that was well received. But I'm not the best judge of that.
Was it possible to make an effort, if somebody wasn't a very good teacher, to ask him to leave and get somebody else?
Yes, such efforts were made, sometimes successfully, usually poorly, and later I tried to work with the faculty member and get him to see his shortcomings and do something about them.
Do you remember actually doing that?
Yes, in fact, I did it with Dick Hartshorn.
Uh-huh.
When I was chairman, his course on international scene was very poorly received by the students, and I sought to deal with Dick and get him to look at the course and see if there weren't things about it that could be done better. Uh-huh. Really, the course that Dick and Lou Fondkuchen taught, that was called called International Scene in ILS, was the course that they had created around 1945 in the poli-sci department, and also called the international scene. That course was really lifted verbatim.
I see. Mm-hmm.
It was not designed especially for ILS.
Uh-huh.
And that, I think, was one of the shortcomings of the course. At any rate, Dick had a very keen mind and loved to talk. He talked at faculty meetings, virtually every meeting, often at great length. But he did not have an effective manner when people had to listen to him mm-hmm. for a whole hour. And his international scene course was considered one of the weak courses, and many students sought devices to avoid taking the course. Now, Fondkuchen sometimes taught that course, but Fondkuchen did not really do any better with it. Both of them had settled on a course about 1945, and they never abandoned that course.
That's very unusual. It's never done in a department, is it, to take a faculty member aside and say, could you improve your teaching?
Well, I think it is done. I think that a chairman has to do it sometimes.
I've never heard of it. It's a terribly touchy thing.
Mm. Now, I know that in the second year of ILS, the fourth humanities course, American Culture, was taught by a man named Frederick Huffman in the English department. Huffman and the students did not get on well, and Huffman resigned from ILS at the end of the first semester. I don't know whether he and Pooley had any disagreements about this or not, but at any rate, Pooley was very happy to have him resign.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another faculty member in the 60s, John Barker of the History Department, who's still active today. Who took over Reynolds' course when Reynolds could no longer stay with it for health reasons. Barker is an exceedingly bright historian, but he can't resist including everything that he learned about history in high school, in college, in grad school, and in his reading since, so that his course, Transition to Industrial Society, second semester social studies, was a disaster because he tried to include everything.
Yeah.
He had a workbook which included names that students should learn to identify. I remember one time when I was trying to get Barker to see the light, we looked at his workbook, and there were always about 25 names per lecture. And I asked him, John, what would happen if a student didn't identify Hildegard of Bingen? Would that destroy the flow of history? I asked John one time whether a student would fail to understand the flow of history if they didn't know who Hildegard of Bingen was. And John insisted that it couldn't be done without including all of these names. It is my own feeling about history that...
it's okay.
It's my own feeling about history that a student coming into the subject fresh must not be bogged down by all sorts of endless detail, but that the student must begin to appreciate the flow of ideas, the flow of experiments in history of science, the significance of certain experiments to the exclusion of all sorts of detail. Mm-hmm. And John could never see that. So he and I tangled rather viciously. I sought to help him to get control of this course, which was becoming a disaster, rather than booting him. But a couple of years later, after things were getting worse and the student activism was really getting to him, he offered to resign, and I immediately accepted his resignation, which I think was a great blow. But here's an example of a chairman who does interfere with faculty.
Well, one thinks, of course, from the outside that it's something that ought to be done more often.
It ought to be done more often, but chairmen, I'm sure, are very reluctant to do it. I know that Pooley had some unfortunate choices, and he tried to work with them or work around them. In general, the ILS faculty was much better than a student would run into by accident in the usual selection of courses. Agard was always a star whom the students loved. Pooley didn't have quite the same stature, but the students were never dissatisfied with his course. Bob Reynolds was a delight, a brilliant scholar who had the capacity to bring his subject to the students and have them see the flow of history without getting them bogged down in infinite detail. Lowell Noland was probably the real star of the program. He was with the students two semesters, even the semester when the course was primarily botany. He was always running a section and would look into the laboratory, get to know the students by name. He knew all of the students in his course by first name after a few weeks. And he was not a charmer in the lecture room, but his sincerity came through, and he had beautiful hands, which were very expressive. And you could see that little amoeba jump when he portrayed the kind of activity that the amoeba or the paramecium or whatever had. And the students loved him, and respected him. They respected his knowledge and his capacity to get it across, even though his lectures were never of the same polish as Poulet or Agard. Of the sequence of courses, the humanities courses went quite well on the whole. Agard and McKendrick got Greek and Roman culture off to a good start. Gaines Post continued with medieval and Renaissance culture. And Poulet dealt with European culture in the late Renaissance, early Enlightenment period. And the fourth semester was American culture. Hoffman did that only once, and it wasn't very satisfactory. Paul Wiley did it for many years thereafter, with rather indifferent results. The social studies never really gelled. The international scene course was never, it could have been the backbone of the program if it had been done well. But Hartshorne and Fontkugel never really got with it. And transition to industrial society, the second social studies course, was very well done when Reynolds was active. But his circulatory system was so bad that he had to give it up early in the 60s. Now, as far as the science is concerned, I think physical universe went quite well. The earth science course was never bad, though it was the least liked of the four semesters. And then the biology under Noland was superb. Noland started out the course with Huskins of Botany as a co-teacher. And the first semester was largely botany, and the second semester largely zoology. Huskins was a brilliant botanical scholar who had excellent educational ideas, but was not terribly effective with freshmen or sophomores. But Noland saved it from being disastrous. And Huskins contributed enough that was good that the students stuck with it. Now, he died not many years after the start of the program. And from there on, the botany part of it sputtered a good deal. The botany department never wanted to let anybody else of stature become involved. In the case of Huskins, Huskins was a very strong-willed person who fought the rest of the botany department and did as he pleased. Or almost so. And so he could get away with teaching in this program. But when ILS sought to involve a good and new botanist, they always dragged their heels. They couldn't spare somebody. So that for a number of years, an assistant of Huskins named Mary Saunders taught the botany part, gave the plant lectures, and Nolan did the rest of the course. They worked in collaboration. But she had no clout in the botany department. She didn't have a permanent appointment. And as an instructor, she was looked down upon, partly because Huskins had a number of enemies in the department, and so she was a holdover of that era. Well, around 1959, Noland went ahead and persuaded Herbert Clark of the Botany Department to become associated with him and to have large responsibility for the plant part of the course. And Herb was connected with the course until near the end of the 60s. Now Herb was looked down upon by the Botany Department because he didn't do very much research and gave most of his attention to his introductory botany classes. So they said that he wasn't a good botanist. In fact, Herb was the old-fashioned sort of botanist that was contemptuously referred to as a naturalist in that day, in contrast to the experimentalists who were becoming the respectable botanists. So Herb gave faithful service in the biology course during the rest of Noland's period and then continued on with Bill Burns of the Zoo Department after Noland retired. But at the end of the 60s, both Burns and Clark decided to step aside. Clark was getting toward the end of his active years anyhow, and Burns had other irons that had to be kept warm. So the biology course then fell upon some indifferent days. Now, you had something you wanted to inquire about.
Well, it just strikes me that it was clearly of utmost importance in this course to have a very good teacher.
That's
for each
right.
course.
Yes.
And that's not usually, that is not necessarily the case with a course that's delving into facts and details.
Exactly, yes.
So, were you aware of this when you started, that it was really going to depend on the skill of the person as a teacher?
I didn't,
or it was Pooley, I mean. I think
that Pooley was aware of this, and as a result of that awareness, built a very good first faculty.
With the exceptions, though, that you mentioned.
With a few exceptions, yes. However, in some respects, his faculty was so good that they often went on leaves of absence, and then it was necessary to bring in someone else to substitute for a semester or two.
But you must mean that they were doing research.
They were doing research, becoming involved in things which took them away from the campus for a term or two. Reynolds took several leaves of absence. When he was gone, his course was generally taught by one of his recent PhDs, whom they brought back to teach his courses while he was away. But Reynolds was on leave of absence several times. Paul McKendrick in the Greek and Roman went on frequent absences to work on archaeological problems. I was at Harvard in 51-52, so my course then was turned over to other people. And that pretty much proved to be a disaster because four faculty members in the sciences became involved. And it was a case of everybody's responsibility and nobody took the responsibility. Other people went on leave of absence. And when that happened, we very often had an inadequate substitute because the departments had a strong say in who they would spare to teach the course.
Which would always be whom they value the least.
Somebody that they didn't value to teach their own courses were shunted off to ILS. And this became a problem in the 60s. During my chairmanship, because the good old hands were retiring, or in the case of Gaines Post, went to Princeton. Mm-hmm. So we had to make replacements around 1965, 66, thereabouts. Now, I pulled a real coup about that time when the econ course, American Industrial Society, was up for grabs. The econ department wanted to pass off one of their people who wasn't teaching their own course very well. And I talked to Elizabeth Rauschenbusch about an idea that I had. Would it be possible to get Harold Groves to teach the ILS course in economics? And she said, well, why don't you ask him? I did, and he was 3 years from retirement, but was delighted to be asked, and made the economics course click. For 3 years, it was well taught, and the students found it the most exciting course in the program.
That's interesting.
Yes, yes it is. In his second year, he had a heart attack, and some of his colleagues covered the course for a few weeks. And then he began lecturing from his office at home until he could get back into the classroom.
You mean on a cassette tape or?
An arrangement was set up where he could give his lecture into the phone, and it could be amplified into the classroom. But those were glory years for that econ course, the only years that it was really well taught. Jim Early didn't do a bad job, but Jim lacked a certain spark. Harold Groves had an honesty, a sincerity about him that went over with the students. And this was the time that there were very serious economic problems on the national scale. Groves would walk into the classroom and say, well, I just had a phone talk with Heller up at Minnesota. Heller was one of his PhDs. And of course, Heller was quite actively involved. I think he was chairman of the Committee on Economic Advice to the President at that time. So Groves had this tie-in with what was going on the national level, and the students loved it. So that, I felt, was the real coup of my chairmanship. A lot of other things were failures, particularly in connection with student protest during that period.
How many of the faculty did manage to do research at the same time as they were teaching in ILS?
I'd say about half did kept up fairly effective research programs, yes. Agard published a number of books dealing with ancient Greece, but he was not really considered a strong research man. And McKendrick, on the other hand, was very much into strong research in archaeology. Maryland was doing a modest amount of research. Huskins was a very strong research botanist. And Early was doing some economic research. Let's see, who else? Well, the first people teaching earth science. Well, in fact, all of the people teaching earth science did some research. Generally, the people who taught ILS courses did not carry a heavy research program, but more than half of them were doing quite respectable research work, directing grad students and things of that sort. Yeah. Post and Reynolds both had strong historical research programs.
There's no visible philosophy or math or languages in the ILS program.
That was deliberate. It was felt that it would be difficult to design a mathematics course that would have a good deal of breadth and still be a respectable course. In the field of science, my approach and the approach of some of the others was that we won't attempt to cover these fields. We will look at a few important developments of a kind of case history approach. James B. Conant of Harvard had just published his book on understanding science and started his case history science course in the Harvard general education program at that time. And I was immediately influenced by that, and in fact my leave of absence in 51-52 was to go out to Harvard for a year and work as a teacher in that program. So I was intimately associated with Leonard Nash and Tom Cohen, who were Cohen's right hands. Cohen was beginning to drop out of the course at the time I was there. He did only one of the cases at that time, but the course was well established, and I had a chance to work closely with it, and I was already using some of the ideas, but I developed them further in my own course after I came back.
Were you teaching at Harvard pretty much what you had taught here, although you were expanding it?
Well, a lot of the content was similar. Uh-huh. Some of it was quite different. I didn't have much emphasis on electricity. They had a whole case dealing with electrical science. So that was new. And they had a fermentation case, which I have never used. On the other hand, my course started with the development of the Copernican view of the heavens. First, a look at the Ptolemaic view of the Earth-centered heavens, and then the shift to the Sun-centered heavens and the reasons for it. It's a beautiful case history because the Earth-centered system is quite logical to anyone standing on Earth and looking at the sky. And it explains a great many things that need to be explained about heavenly motions. But when you get down to fine details, the Earth-centered system doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the Sun-centered system does work if it's appropriately manipulated. So it was a beautiful case to use for students at the freshman level, some of whom had virtually no science, a few of whom had had a fair amount of high school science. But this was not something that came out of high school science. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful example that could be used to show how scientists think, how they cling to outmoded ideas in spite of better evidence. Mm-hmm. And I always felt that my physical universe was a course in how scientists work and think rather than a course in astronomy, physics, and chemistry. I used examples out of these three sciences, but I was attempting to show how the scientific mind functions.
You had already started being interested in the history of chemistry.
Yes.
Before ILS started.
Oh yes, I had.
So you were
I've
already
been teaching
in that.
History of chemistry since 1946.
Uh-huh.
So I had an interest, and of course that year at Harvard I had a chance to really get into history of science with George Sarton and Ivy Cohen. So that year essentially diverted my scholarly field into history of chemistry, whereas before that I had been working along experimental lines in my research.
You do mean history of chemistry, not
history
of science.
Of
okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was it Did you have a feeling, or you can perhaps use yourself as an example, that people approach this necessity of changing their style of teaching and the content with great excitement, and did they go and try to find a...
Some people approach it with great excitement. Harold Groves did, for example. I think I did. Not everyone does. John Barker wanted to keep on teaching his medieval history course.
Yeah.
In the same way that he'd always taught it. And this was one of the problems in staffing ILS courses. We never quite got across the point that ILS was an interwoven fabric of ideas as against an organized set of facts and theories about a discipline.
Well, that reminds me of a question that I had wanted to ask, was whether you did meet together and discuss what you were teaching and see how you could relate to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did, especially before any classes had to be met. Mm-hmm. That year before, when Pooley was pulling together a faculty, we had numerous meetings.
All of you?
All of us.
That would be
great. In which, from time to time, we would present an outline of what we thought we were going to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be discussion as to how this fitted into other people's courses.
I'm really disturbed about the noise on that.
The idea was that this is an integrated program and the courses are supposed to intermesh with one another.
Mm-hmm.
We can use one another's material to amplify our own teaching. And so in the original faculty, this was discussed quite seriously. Not everyone took it seriously, as it turned out, but this was the intent. And Pooley was very concerned that these courses be integrated and have relevance to one another.
Where did these meetings take place?
In Pooley's office, 102 Bascom.
Uh-huh. And were you really working at it? Were you serious and concerned about it, the group? Or was everybody trying to finish up as soon
well,
as possible?
Well, certainly most of us were quite serious about it. People like Agard, McKendrick, Reynolds, Post, Ide, Noland. And another thing happened in the first couple of years. Some of us began attending other people's lectures.
Mm-hmm. Pooley mentions that.
Yes, I think he does. I attended the lectures of the whole freshman program, and I started the lectures in the sophomore program, but picked up a case of virus pneumonia in November and had to drop out. And I never did go back to the fourth semester courses except in the biology. But McKendrick sat in on my course and I think some other courses. The Howes sat in on my course. Noland sat in on courses through the program. I think he missed only one course or two in the whole program.
Goodness. What a time-consuming thing.
Very time-consuming, but he was a dedicated man, and he wanted his course to fit in with the rest.
Did you give each other suggestions since
yes.
you were sitting in as to the content and to the teaching?
Did. Yes.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you could do this in good spirit? And
This was always done in good spirit, as far as I know. Yes.
When you were talking about your courses in the meetings, would you then, if listening to somebody else present his course content, say, could you fit this in to what you're saying?
This was sometimes done.
Hmm.
Or sometimes it would be said that, well, I had intended to deal with that, but since you're dealing with it, I will drop it out of mind. Yes, this happened.
So it was a very different experience for all of you from your teaching in your departments, I should think.
It was a unique educational experience for those of us who were in the original faculty. Now, that was never repeated later on. Hmm. And as new people came into the faculty, I know of very few cases where they sat in on someone else's courses. In the sciences, there was a tendency to do that. Hmm. When Lyle Horn took over the Earth Science course from Reed Bryson, Lyle inquired whether he could sit in on my course, but more than that, would I let him run a discussion section in my course? And he did for one term. Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yes, yes, that's real dedication, because this is beyond line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And academicians generally don't like to take the time to
Why hadn't you institutionalized this practice of meeting and discussing your courses so you'd go on doing it after you had new people?
Well, it's very time consuming.
This is a continuation of the interview with Aaron Ide. This is take four. The interview starts at about line 15.
For other faculty to go to that person's course, we tried, in fact, to interest people in sitting in on courses, and once in a while this was done. The Howes were rather faithful about mm-hmm. sitting in on a number of courses.
If you were doing this again, is this something that you would try to insist on, that new people should get acquainted with the other courses?
Yes, I would think that it's something that should be insisted on. But it's a difficult thing to enforce, because faculty members have pressures of all sorts, especially young faculty members. Now, remember that the original ILS faculty was mostly tenured at the time the program started. I was untenured when I was recruited, but by the time I started teaching, I was tenured. And I think of no one who was an assistant professor at the time of being recruited into the original faculty. So you see, tenured faculty can be more freewheeling in doing what they think is right,
mm-hmm.
Whereas untenured faculty, especially today, are under enormous pressures to produce.
That's,
or
yes.
else.
The students had to presumably get their language requirement as their electives, is
yes.
that right?
Yes. This was specifically spelled out, that ILS absolves the student of all general requirements except math and language.
Oh, I see. So they did get math also.
They got math also. Now, many of the students in the early days didn't have to have math. If they entered with two units of high school math, they didn't have to take more math if they were going into a humanistic or social area. Well, we can't win today, can we? Well, at any rate, math and language were generally the elective courses that were taken by entering mm-hmm. freshmen. They had room for one elective.
Besides those two, you mean?
Besides the four ILS courses.
Oh.
There was a composition course of 2 credits, as well as the 3 sequence courses.
So they really didn't have any freedom outside of ILS, because they had to have either math or language in that. Unless they had the exemption, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. If a student was going for a BS degree, in, say, a social science major or a humanities major, they didn't have to take math.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were in a social science major, they could even avoid language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, that got ILS into trouble in the 60s, because a new curriculum in the general course was created, which required both math and language. And this hurt ILS rather badly.
Because it left the students with less freedom to take?
The students had an almost inflexible program the first 2 years, yeah, when you considered the math and the language that they had to take. Mm-hmm. Before that, it wasn't a serious problem. Now, ILS never attracted a lot of science majors, so the math language problem didn't exist in the early days for very many students. But after that curricular change in the early 60s, ILS became a very inflexible program.
Yeah.
And we brought in the math and the language. Can we talk a bit about students?
Well, that's what I wanted. I'm just looking through to see if I had any more. No, I'm ready to talk about students.
All right. I think the ILS students had a lot to do with the success of the program, especially in the early days. It was presumably a general group of students in letters and science, but it turned out to be a self-selective group, which was a bit better than average.
Mm-hmm.
There was no particular requirement that students had to come with a certain high school achievement. They selected the program on their own. And the first year, we had a two-peak distribution, a large peak of students who were somewhat better than average in high school, and then a little peak of students who had been very poor in high school. We lost that little peak almost immediately, and over the years the profile of student abilities was skewed a little bit better than average for the letters and science student freshman body.
There are some evaluation results of students and how they fared after in the next years,
mm-hmm,
and it evidently shows that they were above.
That's right, and I wish that there were money and desire to do a study of what these students are doing now. I think that, I know that there are quite a few who have reached rather important spots in their profession.
Mm. Well, maybe if this alumni association gets going, it would
be something that would be interesting to explore.
Mm. Did you get many vets?
The GI bulge was just about over by the time we started. We got some vets, but not a large number because they had been coming in the previous years. We had some rather interesting problems with respect to types of students. About 1951, the School of Education was starting their elementary ed program. And at that time, they felt that they wanted all of their entering students to go through ILS. We in ILS resisted that, but said we'd be happy to have any students who wanted to elect the program go through. And we did have a fair number of elementary ed students come into the program for a few years. They had difficulty with the program, and they tended to drop off after a few years of experience.
Then what a pity. It's a perfect, what a perfect background for an elementary teacher, but I know that in general they're a lower level of
ability. That's right, yes.
Ability.
But the committee that set up the elementary ed program was quite enthusiastic about ILS because they said, look, if we could educate an elementary ed teacher along this path, that it would be ideal for dealing with.
I'm amazed that the education school had the kind of foresight to realize that.
There were a number of people, including John Guy Fawkes, who were quite enthusiastic about it. And then when the students actually began getting into these courses, they didn't do well, and and they tended to drop out. There were some, in fact, over the years, we always had some of the good elementary ed people, and I think that some of the advisors were deliberately shunting them that way. Now, the other group that was involved early was the Ford Scholars. Now, there was a program sponsored by the Ford Foundation for early admissions to college. They took very bright high school sophomores and juniors and sent them off to college. University of Chicago was quite influential in setting up that program. Wisconsin was one of the schools that cooperated in the Ford Scholar program. So, the people setting up the Ford Scholar program wanted to put everybody in ILS. We objected as a faculty to that because we foresaw certain problems. And we thought that it would be well if some were in and some were not in.
Can you say what the problems were you expected?
Well, for one thing, this was a fairly sizable group of students. I think somewhere 30 to 50 students. And in a program with not more than 200 students, it would have skewed the student population rather badly. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that these kids were very bright, but also many of them were socially very immature. And they were a problem almost from the beginning. In fact, it hurt ILS for a few years when there were quite a few in.
How did that manifest itself?
In antagonisms. ILS was a tough grading program. And if you throw in 25 Ford Scholars, who are very bright, they will pick up a lot of the A's and B's.
Oh, really?
And push other people down into B's and C's.
And be younger to boot.
And be younger to boot, yeah. These kids were intellectually able to handle ILS without trouble. But socially, they were quite immature. Some of them were real social problems.
You mean they misbehave in class, or?
Well, they tended to be loners. They didn't easily set up friendships with other people in their classes. And they tended sometimes to be arrogant about their intellectual ability. And that turned off other students in the class. Mm-hmm. The Ford population of students dropped off fairly rapidly after a couple of years. But for a while, they presented some real problems. Really, the worst problem, I thought, was their attitude that ILS courses were preventing them from getting on with what was important. And what was important was learning science and mathematics so that they could become great research scientists right away or go into medicine at an early age. A lot of these kids moved toward medicine and law. Mm-hmm. Well, ILS, they looked upon as an interlude which was holding them back from getting on with a professional goal.
Yeah. It could be a disturbing influence.
That's right, exactly. So we did not try very hard to keep Ford students in the program after we had a little experience with them. But it was an interesting experience while it lasted. That program was ultimately phased out. Though I think it had some influence in causing colleges to be willing to accept bright students who hadn't yet completed a high school diploma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or to let them take courses on the campus.
Right, yes. Now, I'd like to talk just a little bit about general student attitude and enthusiasm in those early years.
I'd just like to say a little question. How did they find out about ILS?
Well, this has always been a problem with the program. The program is not well advertised, and we never found a way of getting it to the attention of high school graduates in a good, reliable fashion. Mm-hmm. The best recruiters proved to be students themselves. They would go back to their high schools and tell friends who had been in underclasses that this was a good program and they ought to try it. We got a lot of recruits that way. There began to be a group of high school teachers, not only in the state but outside the state, who learned about ILS, probably through a student who had gone back and told them that they were enjoying the program. And these high school teachers became good recruiters for us. We sought to get material on the program to advisors in the high schools and so on, but this never worked out very satisfactorily. I guess that advisors in the high school run into so much literature from the colleges that they tend to throw it aside.
What about the freshman advisors? I mean, when people are registering?
The faculty freshman advisors were sometimes antagonistic toward ILS and deliberately withheld information, or if students ask about ILS, they'd say, well, that's not a program for you. After all, ILS was not a popular program with the faculty. Never was.
Ever.
In spite of that, we had a lot of faculty kids in the program. A great many faculty children were in the program every year. So it had respect from a certain part of the faculty, but there were many faculty who were antagonistic and wouldn't tell students about it, or if the students asked, they would soft-pedal it.
Even if it began to be apparent that the ILS students were doing well in their junior and senior years,
yes,
they weren't persuaded.
They weren't persuaded. In some cases, they were. That is, I suppose a program like American Institutions, Far Eastern Studies, programs like that, like to have students come through ILS because they did well in such programs. Interdisciplinary programs in general tended to welcome ILS students. But departmental programs were not terribly enthusiastic.
You mean an English major or history major wouldn't be that superior or that noticeable?
Well, I think there were no problems as far as most English advisors or history advisors were concerned. I'm thinking of the sciences in general.
I see, yes.
The social areas like anthropology, econ, political science.
I can see that, yeah.
Yeah. These people did not. And I think many times these departments did not realize that some of their good students had come through ILS.
One other question for the beginning. You had said that no more than 300 could enter, and you got 204. Was this disappointing?
Yes. Yes, it was. Though I think considering the lack of publicity that the program could get by that time, it was probably about what we might have expected. But we were rather enthusiastic, and I think all of us thought that, well, everybody ought to be attracted to this. The program grew slowly. It had ups and downs. In the early 60s, it took on quite a bit of popularity for a few years, and we got up to the 300 peak. And then we went to the faculty and asked for a 400 peak, and the faculty gave it to us, surprisingly. But the year that we had the 400 peak, we had a heavy loss in the second semester and the third semester. Mm. Students, you see, could slip out of the program at the end of any semester. Yeah. You couldn't enter, but you could slip out. So we always had some attrition. But that 400 student class had a lot of attrition. I think we must have picked up marginal students who were dissatisfied with grades, and they soon started to drop off. So we never, I don't think we were ever beyond 300 after about 1965 or 6.
I had another question. If you had fewer students than you expected, you must have had smaller classes.
Yes.
And this must have reverberated in the rest of the university, I suppose.
The rest of the university was always looking for ILS disasters. And so if there was a drop-off of enrollment, this was looked upon as a portent of failure of the program.
But what I meant was that you would have fewer students in your classes. It would be a pleasanter situation of teaching, and wouldn't they be jealous of that? I don't know.
I really have no basis for reacting to
that. How big were the classes on the...
Well, we ranged anywhere from, I think there were a few semesters that we had as few as 130 starters. And
I meant your own, in your classroom.
Well, in lecture you would have the whole class, whatever was registered.
Oh.
In discussion sections, we tried to hold the discussion sections to about 20. And they tended to run just below or just above, but right around an average of 20.
And you were doing the discussion sessions mostly yourself?
No,
or you,
no,
you used
we
TAs?
Had teaching assistants. We used TAs.
Mm-hmm.
Each course had discussion sections, and each course, therefore, had a core of TAs. Recruiting TAs was a problem because most graduate students did not have the breadth of disciplines that some of the ILS courses demanded. And probably my physical universe course was one of the most difficult in that respect because it drew material from three major physical sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take a chemistry major, he will have had a physics course at least, but he hardly ever would have had an astronomy course. If you took an astronomy major, he would have had a physics course, but probably no chemistry.
Hmm.
If you took a physics major, he might have had neither astronomy or chemistry.
You could have perhaps joined two and had a double discussion.
Yes, but that becomes more expensive, and deans don't like that. I developed the policy in recruiting TAs of looking for people who were interested in teaching and had a background in one of the physical sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I perhaps used more chemists than physicists. And for a time I used some of the earth science TAs, and then they could teach in both my course and the earth science course.
Mm-hmm.
Though we ultimately abandoned that because the people who came from geography or geology frequently had almost no chemistry. And so it tended to work out better if we did our own recruiting specifically for our own course. And I could usually have my TAs teach in a freshman chemistry course the off semester. But it was difficult to find adequately prepared TAs. What I did was look for people who thought they liked to teach and showed some evidence that maybe they could. Sometimes I recruited people who were already teaching in one of the sciences and had a good reputation there.
Mm.
And then I tried to help them to understand what was necessary in the classroom this next week. I used to have weekly TA meetings on Fridays, and we discussed the work of the next week. And I went through with them the sort of things that they could anticipate, things that they ought to watch out for. And they had a chance to ask questions on things that they were having problems with.
These were successful, were they?
Quite successful on the whole. I won't say I had no failures, but...
I mean these meetings.
These meetings were very successful. Mm. In fact, I would say essential.
Did you go on having them in the late 60s?
Oh, yes. I did, right up to the time that I retired.
Oh.
I kept having TA meetings. Of course, this is a heritage in some respects from the chemistry, the general chemistry program. Most of the people teaching freshman chemistry courses have a weekly TA meeting.
Mm.
And I grew up under Crosscup and Walton, and they used to, every Friday afternoon, get all the TAs together for an hour and discuss what was coming up, what needed to be done, what to watch out for in the laboratory, and deal with questions that the TAs had. Now, I think this is rather essential. If any course is going to be successful in the university, you don't just hire TAs and then turn them loose, tell them to sit in on my lecture and take it from there, or sometimes not even that. I think that the successful science courses generally have teachers who pull the TAs together at fairly regular intervals and discuss with them what's coming up. We've always done it in chemistry, in the freshman program at least. I don't think it is done too seriously in the upper class levels that use TAs. And I have no idea how many other science courses do this sort of thing. But I would hope that they did.
I'm not sure. I know some people do. I'm not sure.
Yes, I'm not at all sure either. No.
Well, you had.
Well, I wanted to comment about student enthusiasm in the program, especially in the early years. We brought together a group of about 200 students in the fall of '48. Who didn't know what they were getting into, and we didn't know what we were getting into.
Oh.
Poulet proved to be an exceedingly able administrator who not only had good control of his faculty, but immediately developed a rapport with the students.
Oh, yes.
Things worked out very harmoniously. The students developed an esprit de corps, which was very much a part of the program. And over the years, that esprit de corps held pretty well until we got into the age of dissent. When the capability of getting together easily and often caused them to think of ways of rejecting the ILS program,
uh-huh.
finding fault with it, and so on. But up until the mid-60s, the student rapport was excellent. Now, in part, Poulet had a little gimmick, which he inaugurated the very first year, and which we kept for many years. The students are signed up for all the lectures, and then they're signed up for a section number, and that's, they attend the same section in all four courses.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that they got acquainted very fast, and that they began to feel comfortable in a recitation situation with a group that they were with frequently. Now, in the age of dissent, the students took advantage of that and said, well, I can't stand being with the same students in every class
mm-hmm.
that I take. So we ultimately had to abandon it. But Poulet also used to reserve Great Hall at the Union and have the students come in for a little party early in the fall semester.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some of the sophomores put on a little entertainment. This helped to get students acquainted not only with other students, but with faculty that they would have in future years. So these things, these innovations of pulleys, worked out very well to develop a good esprit de corps. Then there was the ILS Pioneer, which was a little student newspaper.
Whose idea was that?
The students.
Not pulleys.
I don't think it was pulleys. I have no evidence that it was his idea. But I think some of the students said, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a newspaper and you could include notices of things that everybody ought to know about, mm-hmm. and students could try their hand at writing poetry or whatever. Profiles of the faculty, mm-hmm. and so on. So the Pioneer was a great success from the start, and it was a popular part of student activity up into the 60s. It fell by the wayside during the Age of Dissent, but in that period, students started preparing competitive newsletters,
oh.
which they circulated, a few of which turned out to be rather vile in language and pointed in argument.
Goodness, I hope there is some remnants of those. I think the archives file goes up that far.
Does it go up there?
No, I don't think it does.
I don't think it does.
I think up into through the...
Well,
the 50s,
I conscientiously saved these things, but I cannot find my file. I don't know if I loaned it to somebody and never got it back. It may turn up yet, but I had intended to give it to archives sometime. But I also have some of the competitive newsletters which came out in the 60s and took the program to task pretty badly.
But stayed with it or dropped out? The people.
Oh, well, some of the people who were most active in criticizing ILS completed the program.
Mm.
And a few of them have been in touch with me since, and they're generally corporate lawyers in the East.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think their ideas may have changed a great deal, but... they gave us a very rough time, and
Was it painful?
It was painful, yes. In fact, the older faculty had the feeling that ILS had a good relationship with the students, and here that relationship was deteriorating badly.
Yeah.
I had an interesting experience. I was chairman of the program from 63 to 70. And so I went through the very worst of this period.
Mm.
In 70, I decided that I couldn't take it any longer. And I told the faculty about 6 months earlier that they shouldn't elect me again, but think of somebody else. Well, at the time that I retired from the chairmanship, I was a very unpopular person with the students. Within a year, the students were eating out of my hands. I was now an ordinary faculty member, a teacher, and they liked my course. And I was suddenly had the kind of popularity that I'd had back in the 50s and early 60s. But while I was an administrator, I was their enemy. And they were not even sure of me in the lecture room and as director of one of their courses. There's a great many of them, I think, had a quite warm feeling toward me, but just the same, there were many who were suspicious, and I couldn't be a trustworthy person.
Yeah. This is...